Mrs. Phyllis White, Veal 3. Your father, did he survive the war?
Yes, fortunately he did, in spite of everything. He was not allowed to leave Singapore, being a government servant. And he was interned with the other civilians in Changi Jail, which was a rather grim place, not intended for Europeans. And he was there from whenever the Japanese herded them into the jail until October 1943, when they had this big sweep through the camp, because they were quite sure that there was some sabotage going on with the connivance of the internees. There was actually a radio in the camp, and I think it got discovered, unfortunately. And he was taken with numerous others to the Japanese Kempeitai headquarters in the former YWCA in Outram Road. And in solitary confinement for 6 months. Meanwhile, the Japanese were interrogating with torture various other people they had swept into their net. And although my father was not touched at the time, because all the screams and yells from the other internees, sufferings reached his ears, which must have been very traumatic. Wondering when your turn's going to come. He was finally interrogated and burnt with lighted cigarettes on his back and his legs. We saw the scars after the war. When he was let out, the internees had been moved from Changi to a former military camp at Syme Road, which is near the Bukit Timah golf course. It was rather rough and ready, but at least they were out in the fresh air. There were huts made with palm and bamboo leaves and attap roofs, as they called them. And he stayed there until the end of the war. The military occupied the Changi jail because they had brought down the surviving men from the railways in Siam, and so they needed the accommodation for them. He weighed 7 stone at the end of the war, like most of the other internees, having lost about 4.
Did it have lasting effects on his life, his internment?
He was a very even-tempered man, and he was determined not to make a thing about it. He told us quite a lot of things when we all met up after the war. It was painful for him to talk about it, and it was painful for us to hear about it. But he didn't go on about it. For a long time, he wouldn't have anything to do with anything Japanese. But of course, gradually, we all had to accept Japanese radios and such like. But he never forgot it. But it didn't really affect his health, surprisingly enough, because the following year, 1946, he went back to Singapore. They were very short of government officers, and they needed law officers. He was still a judge then, and it was useful for him too, because they had the war crimes trials, and he was able to give evidence against many of the Japanese who had run the camps. He did speak up for one or two guards who had behaved in a reasonably friendly fashion, humane fashion. One of the things that he was pleased to be able to be present at was, before he was repatriated, was the signing of the surrender of the Japanese with Lord Mountbatten outside the Supreme Court in Singapore. Gave him the greatest satisfaction indeed.
Well, I suppose now we come on to the Wasbys and how it was that you came to sign on for the Wasbys.
We'll have to go back a little bit. My husband-to-be, after he escaped, he went to Chongqing. He had jaundice. He was sent to India on convalescent leave, and then seconded to the Indian Army and became a gunner officer again in a unit near Bombay with Indian troops. Unfortunately, the senior officers in this camp were not very sympathetic types. He wasn't at all happy there. He was willing to do his duty, but I think he got blamed for too many things that weren't his fault. Anyway, he was able to contact other officers who had escaped with him, who were doing intelligence work, either in Delhi or back in China, and eventually was able to be posted back to China to join a unit called the British Army Aid Group, which was run by Colonel Ride, and his number two was Douglas Clegg, who had been one of the escapees. They had a forward post at Wei Chow, which is quite near Hong Kong. Linton went to Kualin, which is now called Guilin, where you have these extraordinary sugarloaf limestone mountains. The Japanese were not far off, and the American Air Force was luckily had cut a large presence in the area, and their fighter planes went up and attacked the Japanese, and their American planes were used mostly for their intelligence work, picking up escapees. They brought out a lot of Indian troops who had been suborned by the Japanese to join the Indian National Army, but in actual fact they were treated so badly they escaped where possible. But no English, British troops were able to be assisted to leave Hong Kong. The Japanese advanced at the end of 44 and captured Guilin, and that particular office was evacuated to Kunming, and with the improvement in the war going against the Japanese in Burma. There are different type of organization was set up. It was called E Group, and I think it had actually been going E for escape and evasion. It had been going for some time with a headquarters in Delhi under Colonel Jackman. And Linton went to Calcutta and was in the office there, and they were reconnoitering forward areas down to the Arakan and Camilla and Chittagong and places like that prior to plans for possible invasion of Malaya and going further south into Rangoon and so on. And the his CO in China had been this wonderful chap called Colonel Ride.
Is that R-I-D-E?
Yes, Lindsay Ride. Who had been, I think, a professor of pathology at Hong Kong University. And he had his wife and children living in Australia, quite near where we were living. And he hadn't seen them since 1940-41. And so, with various people being helpful and pulling strings and proper military arrangements, a liaison job was organized for my husband to go to Australia with Colonel Ride. And so we were able to meet for the first time for 4.5 years. He flew down from Bombay, Colombo, Perth, then to Melbourne. And he was on leave. And we were married within a fortnight.
Were you able to pick up the threads?
Absolutely.
Just so easily.
Incredible. It was amazing, actually.
It's 4.5 years. It's a long time.
Well,
when you're so young, isn't
I'd
it?
Grown up. And, I mean, he'd changed and all he'd been through and everything. No, he came into the... I was waiting for him in the airline office, which was actually directly opposite the office where I worked. He didn't arrive till 10:30 at night. It was the longest day of my life. And he came out, you know, from the where they dropped him in the bus with all his luggage and baggage and... That was it. It was absolutely marvellous. I don't know. And all the letters that we wrote to each other, I've got two small suitcases full of them, his and mine. And I read them again.
Was this a means of getting into the WASPs?
Well, after we were married, we had two or three weeks honeymoon, and then he had to take up his liaison job. And he flew to Brisbane, and after a few days, I was able to get a permit to go on a train to Sydney. And from there, Sydney to Brisbane, it took 3 days. And not in the same train, because you have to keep changing trains at each state. And we were in Brisbane for 6 weeks while he liaised with this newly set up Australian office, which was planning possible invasions into the East Indies and so on. It was all fairly new for the Australians. And then we went down to Sydney for a bit more free time, not nothing to do with the military. And we came back to Melbourne, and there was a headquarters in Melbourne that he liaised with. And then in mid-April, April 11th again, the day of his escape, he had to leave and fly back to Perth, and then on back to Colombo, Bombay, Delhi, and eventually Calcutta, and give a report on what he'd been able to accomplish in Australia. And we had had hopes that I would be able to get a permit to join him in India, because some wives had been able to come through. It depended how much string pulling you were able to do and what your rank was, I think. Generals seem to be able to get their wives. Anyway, he tried his best, but unfortunately the government clamped down on any more wives coming in. And we were making desperate plans, because at that time we didn't know, of course, that the war was going to finish so soon. And we quite envisaged that it would go on till early the following year, in 1946. And whether we would get repatriation to the United Kingdom. Anyway, I saw this little paragraph in the paper in mid-June that this Lieutenant Massey was down in Australia to recruit English women living in Australia and any Australian women who had pre-war connections with Malaya and Singapore. That was the criterion that the Australian government let them join. Otherwise, of course, they had to be under the aegis of the Australian Manpower Directive. And I think in the first lot that I was with, there were about 24 of us, and then there was a second lot, but it was very difficult to keep track of everybody because we got dispersed.
Did you know anything about the WASPIS?
Never heard of it. Nobody had heard of it. It was known as Mrs. Taylor's private army when we got to India, we found out. And of course, she was an amazing woman who set this up.
Did you meet her?
Yes, met her twice. And luckily my husband met her twice too and tried his charm on her. And she was very kind and let us have leave together.
Was she an impressive woman?
I suppose yes, my memory is rather dim, but I think you could say she was a very typically extremely capable managing English woman of the type that we have plenty of in this country, who get things done if they need to be done. And she must have bearded lots of War Office wallers who probably thought that she was just a pain in the neck. But I didn't realise that the WASPIS had actually been in being in Rangoon before the Japanese drove the British out of India, out of Burma. They'd been doing cyber work and that sort of thing, I think, and helping generally. They hadn't been doing the canteen work.
Were you given a pretty realistic idea of what to expect when you were recruited in Australia by
Lieutenant Massey? I suppose we must have been. I think we all dying to have a chance to get away. And the thought of being able to get back to the Far East was a great draw, I think, for everybody. I mean, some of the people had lost their husbands and lost their homes and fiancés and so on. And it was just something completely different. And of course, the government were paying your passages. Didn't cost us a penny.
Who were the other girls that you were with? Were there many Australians in your group?
Yes, because pre-war there had been a lot of Australians in mining and rubber and business in Malaya and Singapore. I can remember two sisters called Glendinning. They'd both lost their fiancés, or presumed they had, because it had no word of them. They were in the Argylls, who were in the thick of the fighting. And they also had a brother who had been locked up in Hong Kong, so they really had had a sad time. Some of them were married women who didn't seem to have husbands around. I was the only one who had a husband in India. We were all unencumbered with children, because there were many wives whose husbands were in India, but because they had children and they couldn't take them. And some had joined because they thought they were going to have a good time. I'm afraid there were a few like that. And one had joined because she'd had a frightful row with her husband, walked out on him and her family, and she was as mentally and physically ill on the ship between Sydney and Fremantle, and of course repented of her action and was sent back to Sydney. Otherwise, we were more or less footloose and fancy free, as it were. It was a really mixed bunch of people. It was kind of astonishing. I knew one person who joined, who was a friend of my mother's. She must have been in her mid-40s. They had an age limit of 45, I think. And her husband had been the Danish consul in Singapore, and he was going back in the civil administration, and so she thought it was the only way that she would get to Singapore without too much hassle, which she did eventually. We were finally gathered up after swearing an oath of allegiance to king and country and abrogating all our civilian rights, and were put on a train from Melbourne to Sydney, where we spent three dreadful days in some ghastly barracks, a place called Durwood in Sydney. It was very cold. It was midwinter by this time. It was exceedingly, totally unlike civilian life, of course. And the army really didn't know what to do with us, because there we were, a very motley bunch, all in our civilian clothes. My only overcoat was a fur coat, which my husband had sent to me from India 2 or 3 years before. And we had to turn out at 7 o'clock or whatever, what time it was, for Reveille, answer to our names, And then we went back to our beds. And there was a corporal in charge of us. He just couldn't make us out. How she realised that we weren't really under her military discipline. So we were allowed out during the day, and we had to be in barracks, I suppose, by a certain time at night. But it was a great relief to leave that place, and we got onto the ship called the Arundel Castle, which was quite a good-sized boat, but packed with people. There were 12 of us in one cabin. As soon as we left Sydney Harbour, went through the Heads, sea became extremely rough. Most of us were pretty seasick, and so I was for about 6 days. We reached Fremantle, and put on our powder and paint and went into the town and painted it purple. Leaving Fremantle, and we went into Perth. Fremantle is the port for Perth, and it's no distance from one to the other. And I don't think the people in Perth knew what had hit them. We probably thought it was a bunch of tarts, really. Anyway, after Perth, we had a very nice voyage to Bombay. And
was there any threat from, you know, Japanese craft?
Well, the ship was blacked out, but by that time, of course, the Germans had surrendered, and the Japanese Navy had been pretty well pounded to bits by the Americans. So we didn't feel that there was really any great threat to or danger of being on the high seas. I'd known a number of people who'd travelled back to UK much earlier on in the war, which was very brave of them, because there was a submarine threat then. And one of the girls I knew at the university who had come from Singapore, her parents decided to leave Australia. I think they left separately. I think they were going to South Africa. But the mother's ship was torpedoed, and she got taken off and was a prisoner or internee in Japan for the rest of the war. So that rather put me off travelling by sea anywhere. But it seemed quite safe at that time. This was 1945, because really we were on top of the Japanese by that time. We arrived in Bombay, we disembarked 2 days later, went by train, 45 hours in the train, very hot and sticky. There were 4 of us to each carriage. You had a bunk each, but the top bunks were put back during the day, and you sat on the lower bunks. And it was quite fun, really. The only thing was at night, we put up the shutters and locked the doors and so on. Then the train stopped at stations. All the platforms were absolutely covered with Indians waiting patiently for trains, and they swarmed on the trains, rattled at the doors and windows, and it was really quite alarming. And and in the end, I remember shouting at them, hoping that someone would understand English.
Yes, this was during quite a tricky time in India, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was quite a lot of unrest, yes, and they'd had the most dreadful famine in Eastern India, in Bihar and Orissa, I believe, and thousands of Indians were swarming into Calcutta from the countryside. Calcutta wasn't at all an attractive place to my way of thinking. Swarming was very, very poor people. You know, it made your heart bleed to look at them.